Good afternoon. I'm Robert Dakota. I had a lot more to say. It's going to get shortened down. We had a really great time with Graham today out on the land, and it was really nice to have some time to hang with him. I really appreciate his energy. He has been pushing so hard, and I've been observing this from a distance. I want to tell you, this man works really, really hard to come here and present this information to you. And Dr. Rick Strassman, MD, has been invited by Graham, and they're going to have a conversation tonight, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, I'll leave it to Graham and Rick. Thank you, guys.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all so much for being here. I have the incredible privilege of sitting with one of my psychedelic heroes, Dr. Rick Strassman, whose remarkable research on DMT and his book DMT, the Spirit Molecule, and subsequent books, and his film DMT, the Spirit Molecule, have, I think, changed the world and are continuing to do so. Okay, so please meet Rick Strassman. Rick, I'm going to start at the beginning. You undertook, what I regard as one of the most extraordinary research projects in science that's perhaps ever been undertaken, and it was an exploration of an unknown land in a way. I think I and the audience would be interested in hearing a little bit of your personal story. Your childhood, what motivated you, how you became a psychiatrist, how you came to the University of New Mexico. Tell us a little bit about your biography.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for coming. This is the first public presentation or appearance I've made in a few years. You know, so I have to hand it to Graham to, you know, bulldoze me out of my little cave in Gallup, New Mexico to, you know, come here for this event, but I'm really, you know, glad to be here. As far as my upbringing, my grandparents came to the U.S. in the early 1900s from the Pale of Settlement, which was, you know, the only place in Europe and in Western Russia where the Jews could live. And there were pogroms in the early 1900s, and you know, millions of Jews fled from the Pale of Settlement and ended up mostly in the U.S. and Canada. So my parents were first-generation Americans, and they started off on the East Coast, migrated to the West Coast for school. And I was born in Los Angeles, raised in the San Fernando Valley in the, you know, 50s and 60s. It was quite a pleasant place to live back then, orange groves and beach culture and Hollywood and you know, mostly fresh air. I mean, we used to burn our garbage in these incinerators in our backyards, which kind of kindled, so to speak, you know, my interest in fire, explosions, heat, those kinds of things. And at an early age, I actually became quite interested in, you know, chemistry, you know, for the colors, but, you know, mostly for the fireworks. You could buy chemicals at the local drugstore, like saltpeter and sulfur and things to make, you know, gunpowder with. So I began as a, you know, fireworks, you know, teenager, and actually began college as a chemistry major because I wanted to become a fireworks magnate. And everybody discouraged me, you know, telling me I was a smart guy and ought to become a doctor. You know, but I got the last laugh because I ended up studying psychedelics. Well, let's see. I went to, you know, college in the late, you know, in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And it was a in California, and it was interesting, you know, time culturally for a number of reasons. One of which, you know, was the influx of, you know, two technologies that could reliably alter consciousness, which had just, you know, kind of entered the scene, both, you know, psychedelics and Eastern meditation. And they both, you know, seemed to be reliable, techniques, you know, to alter consciousness. The descriptions of what occurred during certain meditations and during certain drug states resembled each other, you know, to some extent. And, you know, being a chemistry buff, I was, thinking there, must be, some, common biological denominators in both states, you know, to the extent that they resembled each other. I was interested in investigating those, you know, similarities. Were there centers in the brain which were activated when you took LSD and when you took or when you practiced specific, you know, kinds of meditation? I went to medical school. Well, I applied to medical school. I actually applied to 21 medical schools, and I was, you know, keen on studying, you know, psychedelics, Buddhism, and, you know, psychoanalytic psychology. But, you know, but I was only 20 years old. And, when I was, when I was doing all of these interviews, you know, for medical schools, you know, usually the first, you know, question is, why do you want to be a doctor? And I told them, and I was rejected by 19 of them. So the two schools I got into, you know, one was about a 3-minute interview, and I didn't, you know, have a chance, you know, to tell them. And the other was, I think they felt sorry for me, and they, you know, put me on their waiting list. I started, you know, medical school kind of in a weird state. Like that isn't why people go to medical school. And I got depressed and, you know, dropped out for about a year, and I ended up at a Zen temple, a Buddhist monastery, and I learned to meditate. And, during those, you know, months at the temple, I was quite, you know, keen on asking the monks, you know, why did you become a monk? You know, was LSD important in your becoming a Buddhist monk? And every one of those junior monks, all in their 20s like me, they all said, we got our first flash of enlightenment on LSD, and we wanted to, you know, take it deeper. So I also, you know, learned to meditate and went, you know, back to medical school, found a good, you know, psychotherapist, and just, you know, kept my mouth shut. Then became a psychiatrist specifically, you know, to study psychedelics, but at the same time, I, you know, kept it under my hat. So once I completed, you know, my, my psychiatric training, I spent a year learning how to do, you know, clinical research, and started off, you know, looking at melatonin and the pineal gland because of the long, illustrious spiritual, you know, history of the pineal. You know, so we, performed a, you know, very, you know, careful study of the human psychopharmacology of melatonin. You know, but it was, mostly sedating. You know, this was the early 1980s. You know, people were, you know, just becoming interested in winter depression and light therapy. And it was, you know, cool to start, you know, looking at the pineal gland from a scientific point of view. You know, so, you know, we established specific endocrine responses, you know, to melatonin. And also it was, you know, frankly sedating. You know, there were some, you know, preliminary studies indicating it had, you know, some profound psychoactive properties, but, you know, melatonin isn't especially psychoactive. So in the meantime, I had learned about DMT. Well, it's also, you know, made in the body. And I was, you know, thinking, if we gave DMT to people and it mimicked the characteristics of a spontaneous mystical or religious or meditative state, that would strengthen the hypothesis, that naturally occurring DMT, which is made in the human body, was responsible for those so-called non-drug states. We had published a number of melatonin papers. I was established as a clinical researcher and started working on the paperwork for doing the DMT study in around 1988. And it took 2 years, and we gave our first dose of DMT in November 90. We gave a lot of DMT to a lot of people, and I also took very careful bedside notes, which is possible with DMT. You can write everything down because it's quite short. Once the volunteers came down, we would chat for about an hour or so, and I would document everything that went on in the room.
Can I pause you there for a moment, just to ask? There must have been a powerful motive behind your decision to do research specifically with DMT, and I'm guessing that was a DMT experience that you had. Please tell us if that is the case, and tell us a little bit about that experience and how it happened.
There's a saying, research is me-search. oftentimes, people have a particular experience or an illness or, something or another, and they, want to understand it. So I was interested in studying psychedelics, and I was interested in the pineal, I was interested in DMT. And I was at a conference in California in 1986, I think, and Terrence McKenna was there. And, we spoke afterwards, and he said, you're talking about DMT, but, do you know anything about DMT? So I said, no, but I'd like to learn. And, so I went into a small, room with a number of friends, and, Terrence, kind of gave me, the introductory DMT rap. Like, this is how you do
it. Imagine that, your first DMT trip at the hands of Terrence McKenna. I mean, come on, you can't get better than that.
So that experience, shook me, to my ontological roots, as it were. There were these beings which were surprising as hell, and they spoke in a sing-song voice and said, now do you see, now do you see, now do you see, over and over again. And I came down, Terrence, was pleased. There were a number of other friends in the room. So we said goodbye for the night. But the course had been set as a result of that experience. So I actually stopped the melatonin work, gave up a grant, started working on the DMT grant, and then the rest is history.
Did you have to go through a lot of administrative hoops? I mean, this was, 1990 that you started the administering DMT?
Yeah.
With the height of the war on drugs. So you must have faced opposition, I would have thought, to starting that project.
It was a 2-year process of working with FDA and the DEA, and it was at the height of the war on drugs, the first George Bush. But it was interesting. I mean, people wanted to see psychedelics studied in humans again, and because our background was quite strong scientifically, I was working with a research unit. I had a good biostatistician, and our study was incredibly modest. Could we give DMT to a group of normal volunteers and generate reasonable data? We used a number of rationales to, to justify the study. You know, one is that, you know, people abuse, you know, psychedelics. Actually, I should, you know, tell you, you know, the backdrop for that story. You know, so I was, you know, I completed, you know, the melatonin study, and my mentor, at the University of New Mexico, had passed away. And the future melatonin studies weren't looking all that promising. And I was in California at the time and stopped off at, you know, Terrence's house. And we spent a day in his library. I don't know if any of you had ever spent, you know, time with, you know, Terrence in his library. You know, but we just, you know, hung out all day. And we concluded, get the war on drugs to give DMT to psychedelic users. And, you know, monitor, you know, their responses. So that seemed like a pretty good strategy. I went back to Albuquerque, worked on the protocol. It was our, you know, funds came from the war on drugs, and it was, and, you know, people, you know, take psychedelics. You know, sometimes, you know, they encounter problems. You know, the pharmacology of those, you know, drugs wasn't that well understood at the time. So. You know, for that reason, it was, you know, decided to be, you know, scientifically meritorious.
So you got the study going, and how many volunteers did you have, roughly?
We studied around, you know, 5 dozen people, like, you know, 55 or so. And, you know, most of those, you know, people got a number of different doses of DMT, small doses, medium ones, and large doses.
And the typical situation was what, that they're on a hospital bed in the University of New Mexico?
Yeah, the studies took, you know, place on the clinical research unit, which was in the university hospital. On the fifth floor, experimental chemotherapy for cancer patients took place there. You know, so it was a pretty life and death grim scene. You would think that injecting, you know, DMT into people in a hospital, on a hospital, you know, bed in a little room with tubes sticking out of the walls and whatnot, would, you know, be the worst, you know, possible, you know, place to do DMT. You know, but uniformly, the volunteers said it was the best possible place to do DMT, you know, because, you know, they were completely at our mercy and completely taken care of at the same time.
Right.
You know, we had a couple of IVs in place. If there were any cardiac problems, there was a response team that could, you know, get into the room right away. And the, you know, volunteers, you know, really wanted to, you know, feel like we had things covered because, you know, what was DMT? I mean, you know, nobody really knew. You know, so with regard, you know, to the, you know, setting, I was interested in the spiritual, you know, pharmacology of the drug. Like, you know, was the drug inherently spiritual? In other words, was the, you know, pharmacology spiritual with no psychological preparation? There was no education, there was no incense, there was no cozy room. There was no mystical experiences. There were just, you know, no goals at all other than to just hold on, remember everything you can, and get back to me and describe what happened. So prepared, you know, the volunteers, you know, by telling them, you know, 3 different things. It's, you know, very fast. It's over quickly. You may think you've died, but don't worry. and in elaboration of the third point, I would say there's a couple of ways to respond, you know, to that feeling that you've died. You can panic, or you can say, "Very interesting. What's next?" You know, so that's, you know, the approach, you know, that I, you know, coached, you know, the volunteers with.
This book, ladies and gentlemen, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. Just as a matter of interest, how many of you in this room have read this book? Quite a lot. Well, those of you who hadn't read it yet, I urge you to do so, because this is a phenomenal study, which really changes our views on everything. Rick, I want to read you... one of the things that I find most exciting about it is the questions it raises over the nature of reality. And perhaps that wasn't even your intention when you went into the project, but it raises fundamental questions. I'm just going to read you a couple of lines from one of your volunteers and the experience that she had. That she meets these, because she's in a void of darkness, suddenly beings appeared. They were cloaked like silhouettes. They were glad to see me. They indicated they'd had contact with me as an individual before. They seemed pleased that we had discovered this technology. So this intrigues me. It's like here is a technology to communicate with another level of reality. Is that possibly what's going on? Have you contemplated that possibility, or is there some? I mean, meeting intelligent beings who communicate with us in what it's an experience, and they're almost saying, great, you've discovered the technology that makes this communication easier. And I suspect that wasn't perhaps the only volunteer who said that.
No. I mean, it was an astonishingly frequent account or report that there were beings, they communicated, they had things to say, there was a exchange back and forth. One other volunteer made the analogy of a new technology. It was interesting. He spoke, so he came in for a number of different exposures to DMT, like a week apart, a month apart. And instead of it being a continuation of one experience to the next, he described it as dipping in to that reality, which a couple of weeks had elapsed from one contact to the next. So it was as if things had occurred in that parallel level of reality, which were going on without his knowledge.
It was like that reality was continuing separate from the volunteer's observations of it.
Right. It was like going to Los Angeles in June and then going to Los Angeles in July.
Right.
Yeah. As opposed to it being a consecutive kind of an experience. Mm-hmm.
Because in another, I'm going to quote you now and your analogy between channel normal and channel DMT. So no longer is the show we are watching everyday reality, channel normal. DMT provides regular, repeated, reliable access to other channels. And you go on to talk about how there almost appear to be freestanding planes of existence. And then you say, and this is radical, these worlds are usually invisible to us and our instruments and are not accessible using our normal state of consciousness. However, just as likely as the theory that these worlds exist, quote, only in our minds, unquote, is that they are in reality, quote, outside us, unquote, and freestanding. If we simply change our brain's receiving abilities, we can comprehend and interact with them. Now, you wrote that some years ago. How do you feel about that view of things now?
It's a very complicated question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a very complicated issue. Especially when it comes to the beings, like are these beings somewhere out there, or somewhere in here, or some combination thereof? So the most the easiest explanation is it's your brain on drugs. There are certain parts of your brain which are stimulated by the drug itself. Visual centers, emotional centers, auditory centers, and those are responsible for the visions and particularly the beings. But in the beginning of my study, I was of the mind of it's your brain on drugs too. And even though I was open-minded with the volunteers about their reports, I think my skepticism bled through some, and they began closing down some. So I decided to do a thought experiment and say, okay, they went to another level of reality, and let's just see where that goes, and then after I'm finished with the study, I can figure out some way to explain that. One of the most striking elements of the DMT experience is the feeling of reality. It feels more real than real. So that makes you wonder, well, upon what do we base our sense of reality? If you posit, well, there's a part of the brain which is responsible for reality orientation, and it's stimulated at a certain kind of baseline kind of level, like right now, for example. If you take DMT, is that part of the brain even more stimulated? If that's the case, then which gets kind of weird, because DMT is actively transported into the brain across the blood-brain barrier using oxygen, which is using energy, which is an extremely unusual occurrence. The brain only will transport things into its confines which are required for normal function, like sugar and certain amino acids. So DMT is actively transported into the brain, which indicates or suggests that a certain amount of DMT is necessary for normal brain function, which is normal consciousness. And if part of what DMT, if part of what DMT is doing is maintaining our feeling of reality, then when you give more DMT, it feels more it feels even more real.
Except it doesn't look like this reality.
No, not generally. It starts to beg the question about what is real. Is this all a low level DMT experience? And when you are on a lot higher dose of DMT, do things break down and you enter into the next level?
Another very interesting area that you touched on, which continues to be a broad public interest today, is the UFO abduction experience, and that you found striking similarities between the volunteers' reports of their experience. I mean, we know they were not being physically abducted because they were on a hospital bed in the University of New Mexico, but their experience in many cases was very comparable to the experiences of UFO abductees. What do you make of all that?
When I began the study, I interviewed some friends, colleagues, contacts that had used DMT before. I think around 20 people. Called them, met with them, and this was in order to establish some kind of baseline expectations about what might occur. And I would say almost everybody described the being encounter. And so I thought, okay, there's a being encounter. A lot of people describe that. But still, I was completely unprepared for the frequency with which our volunteers reported that. And I was forced to start thinking about the abduction literature. I wasn't interested in it at all. It seemed kind of flaky, UFOs and whatnot. Like about one half, through this study, I met with, John Mack, who, published a book. I think it was called, Contact? Yeah, so I started, describing the experiences of our volunteers, and, John said, you've discovered something. But even then I was, reluctant, and I still am kind of reluctant to, think of these, things as, creatures, from outer space. They, more, reside, within us, or we're only able, to perceive them, through our own minds.
Well, what about, it's not so much a question of creatures from outer space, and I'll go into this a bit in my talk later, but that different cultures at different times may construe these experiences in different ways, and in our culture we're construing it as abductions by abduction by aliens. I think one proposition that was put forward is that perhaps UFO abductees are people who spontaneously overproduce DMT. And just if I might add to that, from my reading of you, you're then not going on to say that does not mean their experience is not real. It's a real experience, but in some way mediated by DMT.
I think you know, that is the case. I mean, if you read, you know, the literature of, you know, the abduction experience, you know, like oftentimes individuals are really stressed at the time of, you know, their encounter, and in studies of lower animals, levels of DMT increase with stress. You know, the beginning of an encounter, you know, sounds like the beginning of a DMT trip. You know, there's inner pressure. You know, there's a, you know, high-pitched, you know, sound which, you know, builds, you know, in a, you know, crescendo. It, you know, peaks with the, you know, with the contact experience. You know, so, you know, there were, you know, quite a few overlapping, you know, features of the two, you know, syndromes, as it were.
I've certainly experienced that myself with DMT, both in vaped form and in ayahuasca. That sense of an imminent abduction, that you're going to be taken away into another realm, and it raises fascinating questions about what this whole life experience that we're living is.
Yeah, well, to the extent that, you know, the DMT experience, you know, resembles non, you know, drug, you know, syndromes, it you know, makes a lot of sense, you know, to assume that there is a, you know, common, a, you know, common, you know, biological underpinning.
And that then also is the same with death, and that's why you speak of it as the spirit molecule in a way, I think. And you mentioned to me offstage that there's a new study not yet published which is indicating, well, go ahead and tell us about this new study.
Yeah, well, one of the the gratifying experiences, you know, with the DMT work is I speculate about a, you know, couple of, you know, things in the DMT book, the spirit molecule. You know, one is, you know, that the pineal gland produces or at least contains DMT. And, you know, that book came out in, you know, 2000. And in 2013, there was a group in the University of Michigan, you know, that which established, you know, that there is, you know, DMT in the living rodent pineal gland. You know, so, you know, 13 years later, you know, they confirmed, you know, that theory. And one other speculative, you know, hypothesis that I present in the book is that, you know, DMT increases at the time of death. And the same, you know, research group in Ann Arbor is, you know, looking at the dying rodent brain. And, you know, these are unpublished data right now. You know, but it does you know, seem as if, you know, levels of DMT increase in the dying rodent brain. And if that's the case, you would then, you know, be able to propose a, you know, fairly, you know, tidy, you know, picture of what occurs in the NDE. You know, there are some studies in Eastern Europe, you know, from Hungary, you know, which indicate that in a test tube anyway, if you starve neurons, you know, for oxygen, they begin to die. But if you add some DMT to that mix, it really slows down the destruction of those brain cells. You know, so, you know, DMT is neuroprotective in the dying brain. You know, so if you're dying, your brain is being starved of oxygen. You know, DMT is released. You experience these visions. You know, but that, you know, kind of, you know, begs the question, you know, why DMT, and, you know, why would the brain, you know, secrete a, you know, psychedelic, you know, compound as a, you know, neuroprotective agent as opposed to a, you know, sedating one where everything gets black and warm and, you know, fuzzy and you die. But instead it's this, you know, completely, you know, psychedelic experience. You know, so you could start to think about, well, that's what your subjective awareness is, you know, conscious of as you die. You know, so that is what occurs as you die in your mind. You know, and if, you know, but, you know, what occurs afterwards, obviously, is anybody's, you know, guess, because you no longer have a brain. There's, you know, there isn't any longer DMT. You know, one of the, you know, reasons that I stopped doing my study was the Buddhist, you know, monastery that I had been working with for 22, 23 years started to, you know, chafe under the stress of my discussing the, you know, similarities, you know, between the flash of enlightenment that occurs on, you know, drugs and the flash of enlightenment which occurs through meditation. And, you know, one of the issues that I was interested in, and I, you know, spoke with them over the years, was if DMT is released at the time of death, you know, maybe you could give DMT to people as a dry run. You could prepare them. And the monks said, you know, what if it isn't anything at all like the DMT experience, which would be, you know, doing a, you know, which, you know, could be, you know, potentially, you know, causing some confusion at the time of death. You know, but these studies, you know, coming out of Michigan indicate that, you know, perhaps, you know, levels of brain, you know, DMT are increasing as you die, and that may indeed, you know, be what happens. You know, the obvious study, which I'm, you know, surprised has still, you know, not been done, is you you know, find, you know, people that have had an NDE, give them DMT, and you say, how, you know, similar are they? And a few, you know, people have emailed me, and they said, I had a NDE, I've done DMT, and they're spitting images of each other. You know, but it, you know, got to be a, you know, more, you know, rigorous kind of design, I think.
So you and Andrew Gallimore, and I have the privilege of knowing Andrew as well, have developed a technology, or are in the process of developing a technology, which would allow volunteers to be maintained in the DMT state potentially forever. Anybody who's taken, when I mentioned this to Joe Rogan, he said, "Sign me up." But anybody who's experienced DMT would have to regard that as a formidable proposition. What's your thoughts on this? And will this go somewhere? And I think there's some interest from Imperial College in London in deploying this.
Yeah. One of our experiments in Albuquerque, you know, was to determine if, you know, people develop, you know, tolerance, you know, to repeated doses of DMT. You know, for example, if you take LSD every day, you really stop responding after about 3 days. You know, mescaline, you know, psilocybin, you know, that's the case. You know, so the, you know, that's called tolerance. You become, you know, tolerant. And if you want, you know, the same experience, you, you know, need to increase the dose, you know, to get the same effect. And, you know, there were, you know, there was one study in humans where it was given, you know, twice a day, and, you know, there was no tolerance. There was one study in rodents where it was given every 2 hours for 3 weeks, and there was no tolerance. You know, so I said, well, you got to give it more closely spaced together. You know, so we gave, you know, 4 doses of, you know, DMT in the space of a morning. And so the intervals were a half hour. You know, so we gave, you know, 1 dose at 8, 8:30, 9, 9:30, 10 in the morning. And, you know, there was no tolerance, you know, number one, which was a, you know, remarkable finding. And, you know, number two is that the, you know, volunteers were able to do a lot more, you know, psychological, you know, work under that, you know, kind of a regimen. You know, usually if you smoke DMT, you just, you know, hold on to your hats, and you can't really, you know, work with it all that much. You know, once you get your bearings, you start coming down. You know, but, you know, with this repeated, you know, dosing, you know, protocol, you know, people, you know, could, you know, work on stuff, or at least encounter stuff, you know, then come down. And it was a slightly smaller, you know, dose than our maximal dose. you know, so, you know, we had some time to talk, you know, 10 minutes or so as, you know, they're getting ready for their next dose. And, you know, people were able, you know, to work on stuff like career, love life, spiritual questions. And it was, you know, quite interesting. It went, you know, through, you know, kind of a stereotyped, you know, sequence. The, you know, first experience was big and great. You know, the second experience was a, you know, continuation of that. You know, the third experience, you know, people were just burned out. They said, you know, this is, you know, too much. I'm struggling, all this unresolved stuff. And I, you know, think I want to quit as anybody ever quit after the third dose. And I would say, not yet. And, you know, so they would do, you know, the fourth dose. And, they didn't want to be the, you know, first one who, you know, just, you know, couldn't do it. But, you know, but that, you know, fourth and, you know, final dose was just a breakthrough for a lot of the, you know, the, you know, for, you know, lots of the volunteers. You know, so I, you know, started thinking, well, wouldn't it be, you know, great if you could keep somebody in that state, you know, go up with the rate of infusion, you know, go down with it, you know, or, you know, bring people completely out of it. It would be an extremely useful and extremely novel psychotherapeutic tool or even a spiritual tool. You know, so I, you know, make that, well, in the spirit molecule, I, you know, make that suggestion that in the future it would be of interest, you know, to develop a continuous infusion kind of a model, you know, where you just, you know, keep, you know, people in the DMT state. You could crank it up, you could crank it down. One of my colleagues, Andrew Gallimore, is a, you know, neuroscientist in Japan, and you know, worked out a model, like a, you know, mathematical model. You begin with a big dose, you drop it, you calculate this and you calculate that. It was a, you know, it is a, you know, rather sophisticated pharmacokinetic you know, design. That paper came out maybe, you know, 2 years ago or so, and there is a group at Imperial College in London that's been giving DMT and doing brain scans, and you know, they're, you know, working on actually implementing the continuous infusion study, which will be unbelievably interesting.
Yeah, I think the consequences, the results of that could be extraordinary.
Yeah, you know, one of the strong points of a study like that is you could spend time in the DMT state and you can explore it and you could, you know, learn what the, you know, what the beings, well, you could start to, you know, characterize, you know, the nature and, you know, the role of the beings, you know, because you would, you know, be able to spend an extended amount of time with them. And, you know, one of the possible experiments that a few people have proposed, which would, you know, help establish, you know, the reality of the beings, is, you know, to ask them a question that is impossible, you know, for a human to answer, like the square root of some massive number. And if, you know, the beings are able, you know, to give you the answer, I mean, wouldn't that be something? You know, but, you know, even if the beings were real, there's no guarantee that they'd be interested in answering your question.
Yeah. Or they might be tricky.
Or they, you know, might be tricky, which, you know, they usually are.
Yeah.
You know, they're mischievous and they're, you know, kind of malevolent at times if you're not careful.
Yeah. Rick, I want to move on to your further aspects of your work, and your next book in this field was DMT and the Soul. DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, and in this book you have also had a long-term interest in the Hebrew Bible and in prophecy in the Hebrew Bible, and somehow you bring these notions together. Tell us a bit about this book.
DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. I completed my studies in 1995. You know, wrapped up those, you know, projects for a couple of reasons. Well, actually, you know, more than a couple. You know, we had begun doing some studies giving psilocybin. at the time, finding work, with our volunteers from the DMT study. When I was a resident and I was being trained in giving antipsychotic drugs, antidepressants, things like that, my supervisors always said, give slightly too much and then back down, at which point you know the maximal response to the drug. What we did, with the DMT work. We gave a couple of the volunteers an overdose, and we, lowered it a bit, which, then became our high dose. So we gave, people massive doses of psilocybin, 1.1 milligrams per kilogram. If you look at, the current psilocybin studies, taking place at Hopkins and NYU, they call a large dose or their maximal dose is 0.45. So ours was at least twice as high as what is now being considered a high dose of psilocybin. So those kinds of doses caused a delirium. The two volunteers were red and sweaty and confused, disoriented. So we figured, and they both said, "This is too much. You just can't give this dose to anybody." So we backed down, and our high dose would have been 0.9 milligrams per kilogram, which is still twice what is considered a large dose now. And what's even more interesting is in our volunteers, the threshold for psilocybin being at a threshold dose of breakthrough psychedelic dose, it wasn't until 0.4 around that dose. What is being called a high dose of psilocybin nowadays was our threshold dose for establishing a full psychedelic effect. We also got permission to start an LSD study, and we got the drug, but by then I had answered my question, like, is DMT inherently spiritual? And with our preparations, people were just more of themselves. They didn't the one enlightenment experience in our subjects was a doctor who was a religious studies major in college, and he really wanted an enlightenment experience, and he had one. There was a nurse in our study that was really interested in NDEs, and she really wanted one, and she had one. There was a programmer in our group who was obviously always living in zeros and ones, and on his DMT trip, he saw the source of information in zeros and ones. So the notion that you could just give a drug and cause a spiritual experience was disproven, at least in our study. It depends on the person, depends on their expectations, depends on the material that the DMT is working on. Stan Grof used to call LSD a non-specific mental amplifier. And I think if you don't spend a lot of time preparing people to have a particular kind of experience, then they will just become more of themselves, or the goals or aspirations or their thoughts, which are more or less conscious, become displayed in full relief, and they become convinced of its truth, the reality, the meaning of those ideas, which may have been a little less clear beforehand. You know, so I was a little discouraged. Like I was, you know, it was kind of naive, but I just had to, you know, prove it to myself. Like, is DMT inherently spiritual? And I was kind of hoping it would be, and it, you know, turned out, you know, not to be. But still, you know, the reality experience, you know, the strong experience of reality of, you know, the DMT world, and it's just bizarre in nature. It's just, you know, it's you know, reliably bizarre. You know, nature was it was extremely perplexing, and I wasn't pleased with any of the models that I had, you know, brought to bear on that, you know, research originally. You know, those were three perspectives. You know, one was the "this is your brain on drugs," you know, psychopharmacology model. The other was a you know, psychoanalytic model. Like, you know, these are unconscious, you know, conflicts and impulses and drives, which are then, you know, made you know, conscious. You know, the other, you know, was the Buddhist model. You know, like, you know, this is you know, the progression of your mind towards the enlightened state, which is, you know, completely which is, you know, completely empty of form, feeling, consciousness, perception, understanding. You know, but, you know, nobody really went into that enlightened state other than that one that one volunteer I had mentioned. You know, so those, you know, models really weren't that useful. The, you know, biological, you know, model, you know, just seemed a little too simple. Like, and, you know, when I would be speaking with the volunteers about, you know, what they had just undergone, and they would say, you know, how did this happen? And I would say, oh, it's your brain on drugs. And they'd say, there is no way this could be my brain on drugs. It feels real. It's more, you know, real than anything that I've ever experienced. You know, the Buddhist, you know, model, you know, the Zen model anyway, would, you know, disparage the, you know, content, which is, you know, full in the DMT experience. There's beings, there's light, there's information, there's colors, there's emotions, there's thoughts. And, you know, Buddhism as a rule anyway, you know, the Tibetans put more, you know, credence into those phenomena, but, you know, the Zen, you know, model that I was, you know, working with would, you know, consider all the meat of the experience as ephemeral, you know, kind of, you know, it isn't, you know, really the main thing. And the, you know, psychoanalytic model also describes the experiences as, you know, something other than what they seem to be. This, you know, conflict, or you, you know, love your mother, hate your father, you know, those, you know, those kinds of things. You know, so I went, you know, back to the drawing board and thought, well, I, you know, need to develop a stronger model, one that, you know, fits the data better. You know, so I started to explore, you know, some of, you know, the ideas of, you know, modern physics, parallel universes, dark matter, those kinds of things. You know, and, you know, number one, I'm, you know, no expert in that field. And, you know, number two, even if you described, you know, the mechanisms, you know, by which you might encounter or apprehend normally invisible, you know, layers of reality, you know, what does it mean? What's the importance? You know, what's the relevance? You know, is it going to make us any, you know, kinder as a species, or smarter as a species, or more compassionate? You know, so I switched, you know, perspectives, and I thought, you know, what else, you know, what other disciplines, you know, look at altered states of consciousness and extract useful information, you know, from them? And, you know, clearly, you know, those are, you know, the religious models, you know, the religious disciplines. And I, you know, kind of went, you know, through the Buddhist, you know, model, which, you know, wasn't especially satisfactory.
They excommunicated you, didn't they?
Yeah, I was no longer, you know, welcome after, a formal committee was convened to investigate, you know, what I was, you know, talking about.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so that happens even in Zen. I mean, you know, religious organizations are very interested in, you know, maintaining the status quo and, you know, their own territoriality. So that was a sorry chapter in the book. I actually call it stepping on holy toes. Because it was clearly the case that almost all of those monks got their first, you know, taste of enlightenment on psychedelics. And, you know, to not to be able to, you know, talk about it openly seemed quite, you know, it was quite hypocritical. And it also flies in the face of, you know, scientific discourse. Like, you know, one of the strengths of, you know, the scientific model is you can disagree with each other without being excommunicated. I suppose you can be.
Unless they're archaeologists.
Right. Or astronomers. Yeah, yeah. So it was like, okay, I can't be a Buddhist anymore, but, you know, there ought to be other, you know, religions out there which could, you know, provide a good model. You know, so I'm Jewish, and I figured, well, you know, what's in the Hebrew Bible? So I stopped meditating because I just couldn't stand looking at my cushion for a couple of years. And I went into a New Age bookstore in Port Townsend. I don't know if any of you have, you know, been up to Port Townsend, Washington, but it's this huge, you know, New Age, you know, metaphysical bookstore. You know, so there's, you know, stacks and stacks of, you know, books on Hinduism and Buddhism and Confucianism. And it's like, okay, I don't really, you know, need to, you know, look, you know, there anymore. And upstairs was a small, you know, section on Judaism. And, you know, there was an even smaller book called The Kabbalah of Envy, you know, by a, you know, rabbi from Brazil. And it was a really great little book. It was an introduction to, you know, thinking about interactions as spiritual tools, as opposed, you know, to the enlightened, unitive, mystical experience, you know, where all is one. The, you know, model, you know, that, you know, this guy was presenting, you know, was, you know, that you work out things spiritually in your everyday interactions. And he talks about a story in the Talmud about a couple of, you know, farmers who were arguing over tools. You know, one guy, wanted to borrow a expensive tool. One guy was interested in, you know, borrowing an inexpensive tool. And he then describes how, there's revenge, there's a grudge, there's, you know, jealousy, there's greed, there's envy. And the fine, you know, detail of the interactions was just amazing. It was was as if spiritual truths could be revealed in everyday interactions between two farmers arguing about tools. You know, so I thought, well, and it was interesting, you know, because when I first began, you know, reading Buddhism, it took me a long, you know, time to understand, like, a sentence. I might have to, you know, look at it for a few hours. And, you know, when I stumbled on this other approach, you know, to reality, it was, you know, the same thing. Like, I could not understand the difference between revenge and a grudge. And I couldn't understand the difference between envy, you know, as compared to jealousy. But, you know, once I started to understand that, it, you know, seemed like a rich, rich place to look. And, you know, what I like to do is, you know, look at other people's, you know, sources. So I thought, well, you know, where is, you know, this guy getting his information from? As, you know, the Bible, you know, the Hebrew Bible, you know, the so-called Old Testament. I began, you know, to read the Bible, you know, the Hebrew Bible. You know, when I was younger, I, you know, went to Hebrew school for a number of hours every couple of days after public school, and I learned conversational Hebrew. We didn't really, learn that much about God other than, God, was involved in history, obviously. With the end of the Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel. What was God's nature? How do you communicate with God? What are God's characteristics? We really never discussed that. But at the same time, I had some intimations of spiritual, feelings, within the tradition. Folk dancing, we spun around on stage to extremely, high energy, folk songs. We sang, folk songs. We prayed at the top of our lungs, make the chandeliers sway, our instructor, told us, sing that loud. I swear we were able to make the chandeliers swing. But after I was, bar mitzvahed, as, most, people, I just, dropped it, went into the, Buddhist thing for a couple of, decades. But I knew Hebrew, or I used to know Hebrew. So if you're going to be, reading a spiritual, text, you want, to read it in its original language, for a number of reasons. You can do your own translation, and any translation is an interpretation. So if you're able, to read the Hebrew yourself, you can do your own interpretations, with the aid of, the commentaries. But also, the original, language has got spiritual power. So if you're reading the old text, or you're reading, the text in Hebrew out loud, especially, you can, resonate with the mind that wrote those words in the first place. So it would be an intimation of, the prophetic state. So I, began with, Genesis, in the beginning, God, created the heavens and the earth, which took a few months, actually, for me to get, my head around, because of the, the whole, notion of God as a, creator. So I, started to work, through the text. It, took 11 years to, read the entire Hebrew Bible with a number of the, classic, commentaries. Once I was able to establish some understanding of the text, the notion of the prophetic experience began to appear.
When we talk prophets, let's give some familiar names. We're talking, Moses is a prophet, Daniel is a prophet.
Right. Well, there's, the canonical prophets, which have got, books that, that are named after them, like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, Daniel. But I expand, the definition. When you, hear the word, prophecy, most, people think about, foretelling, predicting. But that is an artifact of the translation from the Hebrew into Greek, which was the first, non-Jewish, translation. So the Hebrew word for the prophet is Navi, N-A-V-I. The Greek translation was prophetes, which means to see ahead, or to see in the future, which reflects the interest in the Greeks and the whole concept of the concept of divining, divination would be to foretell. So the interest of the Greeks in foretelling established the word prophecy. Yeah.
Are you then suggesting that the Hebrew prophets were in a DMT state in some way? I call to mind the work of Benny Shannon and his study of ayahuasca, the antipodes of the mind, and his, I think he specifically suggests that Moses at the burning bush may have been under the influence of an ayahuasca analog, which would be, I think, if I recall correctly, Syrian ruin mimosa hostilis. Is that your line, or are you, or is it some in some significant way different from that?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of points. One is the presence of DMT in the human body precludes the need to locate its source in the environment.
True.
So it could be in plants, might be in the manna, could be in whatever, but the human body contains DMT, and levels increase in certain conditions. To return to my definition of the prophetic experience, as opposed to it including or requiring prediction, my definition is it's any spiritual experience by anyone in the Hebrew Bible. So it could be could be Hagar, the mother of Ishmael, who encounters an angel by the well. Most people don't think of her when you think about a prophet, but if an individual in the text has a dream which comes true, that is a prophetic experience. If somebody is inspired to be a great warrior, like the spirit of God would drop upon somebody, and they would become strong and courageous. That is a kind of spiritual experience. It's a subtype of the prophetic state. And the whole text is a prophetic text. It was written under some divine inspiration, or some kind of inspiration, which would be included in my definition of the prophetic experience.
So to cut to the chase, are you saying that that the prophets are those individuals who are over producing more DMT than the average person in the street does, or is that oversimplifying your message?
Once I began working, once I began to look at the Hebrew Bible carefully, I began to think, well, I wonder what the degree of overlap is between the DMT experience and the classic prophetic experience. So I started to compare the reports in the Bible with the reports of my DMT volunteers, and there's extraordinarily close overlap. I mean, if you read chapter 1 of Ezekiel, there's beings with wings, with eyes on their wings and eyes on their backs. He flies through space, he falls down, there's a whooshing sound in the beginning. He's standing next to water. He's weak, he asks questions, he's completely blown away. There's like a firmament of blue and ice. There's flames, there's spinning wheels, there's spinning globes. It's completely DMT-like. The phenomenology is quite similar. Then you would be forced to start to think, well, is it the case that these spontaneous prophetic states are mediated through the increase of endogenous DMT? The obvious difference between the prophetic and the DMT state is its impact. The prophets live 3,000 years ago. People still read them. They're inspired by them. Perennial knowledge, or perennial wisdom,
perhaps,
as it were.
Perhaps people will be reading Rick Strassman in 3,000 years.
So it's the content of the state, which I think is key. It isn't just the phenomenology. It's the content. What is the message that is being conveyed by the phenomenology? So that leads to the metaphysical theories regarding the prophetic state, the imagination, and the intellect, which gets you really start getting deep in the weeds, but I think it's an important thing to know about and, you know, to learn about.
Yeah. I want to give the audience the opportunity to ask some questions, but and time is running out, but we must not stop without also mentioning a new development in Rick's writing career. There's a curious parallel here, because I'm known for writing nonfiction, but I've also written some novels. And Rick has written a novel, which is, I suspect, largely biographical in some ways. It's called Joseph Levy Escapes Death. And I'm here to massively and highly recommend this book. This is a fantastic piece of writing and is deeply, deeply thought-provoking. And I would like you to talk about it and what led you to it and what your objectives are with it.
Yeah, it's a strange book. Well, I mean, all my books are strange. yeah, you know, consider the source, right? Well, you know, so this cover. I spent a year in 2014, you know, being both, you know, sick and recovering, you know, from being sick. And I spent a lot of time lying on my couch looking at the window at these birds at the feeder. You know, so if it weren't for these birds at the feeder, I mean, this book never would have happened. It's what's called autobiographical fiction, I found out later. It's experiences, you know, which I had, you know, feelings which I had, you know, thoughts which I had, encounters, you know, relationships, you know, which I had, which are, you know, filtered, you know, through this, you know, personality of, you know, Joseph Levy. And it's pretty dark, but it's pretty funny.
It's a dark and funny book. Yeah, both things, and also deeply thought provoking, and relate. You went through a tough time. I mean, I didn't realize fully until we talked last night how much this was built on your own experiences. You really were close to death. It was a very
twice.
Yeah.
It was grim. Yeah, you know, but it worked out. I lived and I got my health back.
How do you feel about writing fiction? How do you compare to writing factual nonfiction books?
Well, you know, this was close to home.
Yeah.
You know, so I worked out my PTSD big time writing this book.
Right.
Because it was pretty traumatic. Yeah. And it was hard to think about, hard to write about. You know, so in, you know, that way it was both, you know, good. It was helpful, but it was also rather difficult. But one thing I like about, you know, fiction is you don't have to worry about references.
Yeah, such a relief.
And like, if you're going to be writing about the Bible, you really want to make certain you've got your chapter and your verse right, because it could be a wild goose chase. You know. So I like that, and it's fun doing dialogue. I learned, you know, doing dialogue from the DMT book. I, you know, took all these notes, you know, during the study, and a lot of it, you know, was the dialogue between me and the volunteer, you know, the nurse and the volunteer, you know, the nurse and me. You know, so I started to, you know, get the hang of dialogue, especially around extreme states and extreme conditions. You know, so I would embellish. You know, one of the things that, you know, held me in good stead is I've always kept a journal. And when I was, you know, sick in this small hospital, it was just incredibly, it was just, you know, hard to believe. You know, so I...
It's really the hospital from hell.
Yeah.
That's what's described here.
And I thought, well, you know, this is a story, so I should take notes. And if I make, you know, make it, you know, through this, I'm going to tell the story, because it's an amazing story. Yeah, you know, so after I came home, I came down with, you know, something else, like a super bug. And I, you know, just, you know, took notes, and I figured, well, I would like to put, you know, pen to paper at some point and, you know, tell this story from the perspective of, you know, looking at it, you know, from, you know, some distance.
Well, highly recommended. Please pick up a copy of Rick's book. It's a different aspect of Rick's work, and it's incredibly interesting and hugely, hugely worth reading. I'm going to take next at least 10 minutes to see if anybody in the audience would like to ask Rick a question. And I have a microphone here, and I'll bring it to you so that others in the audience can hear the question.
Yeah, Rick. Dr. Norman Don at the University of Chicago, we worked with a lot of topographic brain mapping of psychics who are very well known, like Olaf Johnson, to identify the portions of the brain that's active when you have a psi hit. Was there any research done with DMT that did the same type of analysis?
So we did a small study with, I think, three or four people giving DMT, and we measured the EEG. But motion artifact is a problem. With a high dose of DMT, you do vibrate. You have got a very fine tremor, which was reflected in the EEG recording, and we weren't able to filter that out very well. We also gave DMT to a couple of volunteers in a scanner, like an MRI scanner. I don't know if anybody has,
what a horrible place to have a DMT experience. Incredibly clattering, loud noise.
Right. I don't know if any of you, had an MRI, but it's like a jackhammer. It's really noisy. But still, when you're on a big dose of DMT, the outside world just, disappears. And, by the time, they came down, they were fine. They were glad to be alive. And the scan continued. We got the data, but it was also, difficult to interpret because of the movement artifact as well. And, that was, back in the early 90s, and the magnets weren't as strong as the magnets are in those machines now. So we weren't able to analyze, those data, with any, reasonable quality.
Dr. Strassman, thank you for your work. It's been amazing to follow you. One of the things when I've smoked DMT in a group of people, when I've smoked DMT with a group of people, a couple of times, two times it's happened that I've had group hallucinations of entities and beings. And afterwards, when we're done smoking, we all describe it. And, oh my gosh, I saw the same thing. Without describing the beings, because I'm sure they can be different for each person. What's your experience with that, and maybe explanation for that? Have you come across that? Thank you.
It's a very strange thing, and it is reported. And it's also common, with ayahuasca ceremonies, that people in the group will experience the same visions or see the same thing. I don't really know how to explain it. One of the theories regarding the prophetic experience is that there's this thing up there which is called the active intellect. It's a sphere. It's the lowest sphere. There's nine spheres. The lowest one is the sublunar one, which is called the active intellect. The philosophers believe that the active intellect contains every occurrence in the past, every occurrence that's happening now, and every possible occurrence in the future. So it's a vast repository of information. And their belief about prophecy is that one is able to approximate, become close to. It's called conjoining with the active intellect. And that can occur through an intensification of the imagination when you speak about the imagination in a philosophical technical sense. So I think what psychedelics are doing is stimulating the imaginative faculty of the mind, which is the source of the visions. The active intellect can be conjoined by means of the imagination. So it could be, this is quite metaphysical, but it could be that if DMT is allowing a conjoining with the active intellect of the people in the room, you know, that they're able to, you know, tap in, you know, to the same ongoing experiences or events.
Okay, I'll take another from this side. Who shall it be? I'll pass it to you.
I'm going to an ayahuasca retreat in the Amazon in July, and I was curious if there were any known health risks and if there's any lasting neurological effects or damage, and if so, how to prepare for such effects.
Yeah, that is a good question. Well, you need to be in you know, good health, mental health, you know, physical health. You also need to do your homework. You need to be prepared. You ought to look to the site too, you know, to the retreat center, you know, find out if it's a, you know, reputable organization, any, you know, bad horror stories which, you know, have emerged from there.
I'd second that. It's really important that you have some word of mouth on the center you're going to. Others who've been there have had a positive experience, because there are some really crappy ayahuasca retreats which are not sincere and not honest and not good. You have to do due diligence, but if you do that, you'll find yourself in a good space.
Yeah, you know, prepare. You know, find out, you know, what other people, you know, do to make the most of their experiences. You know, if you're on any medication, you would want to make certain that, you know, it won't interact with the ayahuasca. You know, some people, you know, prepare with a diet. You know, they avoid certain foods. You know, concentrate on other ones. You know, get your mental state in order. You know, get your meditation, you know, practice, you know, solid. If you've got a lot of interpersonal conflicts going on, you know, work it out in counseling first, or, you know, get an understanding of what those are. You know, so if they do come up, you've got some, you know, preparation and you're not surprised.
In terms of physical risks from ayahuasca, I would say that the overall volume of research that's been done suggests that they're extremely minimal. So it's physically uncomfortable, but the likelihood of physical damage being caused is very low. You want to make sure your heart is good, your liver is good, your kidneys are good. These are all important aspects. But this medicine has been used in the Amazon for thousands of years, and there's a vast cultural experience behind it. Over on this side.
Well, so they've been doing some long-term studies of long-term ayahuasca users, and, you know, generally they're smarter and they're healthier and they're, you know, better off, you know, than controls, you know, both with respect, you know, to their relationships, their health, you know, substance abuse, those kinds of things. You know, those are data that have been coming out the last maybe 10 or 15 years. But you could still freak out. And if you do freak out, you want to get help right away. Yeah.
Is there anyone in Canada doing DMT research, and how can we volunteer for the extended doses?
Well, so there aren't any DMT studies in Canada. You know, there's only one that's occurring in the world right now, as far as I know, and, you know, that's in London at Imperial College. The Imperial, you know, College is opening up a you know, psychedelic research institute, specifically, you know, dedicated, you know, for studying psychedelics, and it's, I think, going to be opening any day now. You know, the person that's spearheading the continuous infusion study is named, you know, Dr. Timmerman, you can just, you know, track him down, you know, through Imperial College.
He's a very open and accessible guy. You can find him and email him. One more question from this side. I'll take it from you over there, sir.
Thank you. It's been suggested, obviously, that the DMT being produced within the brain and a spontaneous burst could produce a spiritual experience. I have kind of a two-part question. One being, has anybody measured the amount of DMT produced within the brain, and does it compare to the psychoactive dose? And then the other part is kind of the chicken or the egg question. Is your opinion that the spiritual experience is authentically a spiritual experience and that the chemical signature is just kind of red, or is it that the DMT is the explanation for a spiritual experience?
Well, in response, you know, to your first question, it's extremely difficult to measure levels of endogenous DMT. They're, you know, picograms, you know, per mil, like, you know, billionth of a gram, you know, per mil. And I just don't think it's going to be possible with current, you know, technology to measure DMT levels going up or down in unusual states of mind, you know, dreams, you know, near-death encounters, let's say. You know, but, you know, they've characterized the gene that's responsible, you know, for the enzyme which, you know, synthesizes DMT. So I think what will be the case in the future is we'll be looking at the activation of that enzyme and that gene. It's being, you know, turned on or it's, you know, being turned off. With respect, you know, to the chicken and the egg question, I think, you know, DMT is kind of like, you know, silicon in chips. It's the best, you know, candidate for a specific function. So I think that's what is probably, you know, going on is, you know, that it's an accompaniment. And it's, you know, it's an accompaniment and it's also, you know, necessary. I don't think you can have a DMT experience without DMT. But, you know, whether it's a real spiritual experience, I mean, you can, you know, debate that for a long time. You know, it could be considered an experience which resembles a spiritual experience. You know, like, one of the, you know, tendencies in this current wave of research is to call, you know, psilocybin in a, you know, research environment a mystical experience. But I think that's kind of fraught because you give somebody a drug after, you know, 10 or, you know, 12 hours of education and, you know, preparation, and you characterize it as, you know, comparable to what might occur after, you know, meditating for, you know, 20 years in a cave or, you know, praying in a cell all by yourself for a long, long time. You know, so I think the more, you know, modest way of describing those states would be, you know, mystico-mimetic, perhaps, you know, that they, you know, that they mimic the experience. And, you know, mimicked experiences can be quite close to the real thing. You know, reproductions of, you know, master works of art can be, you know, almost master works of art. So I think it depends on, you know, the quality of the overlap and what you do with it, you know, after it takes place.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're now going to take a half-hour intermission. Rick and I will be in a room that I don't know where it is. I hope Robert Dakota is in here or somebody is in here to lead us to that room.
It's in the Universal Room.
Okay.
The signing.
All right. Thank you very much, and we'll see you over there.